In 32 months as a prisoner of war, he faced starvation, freezing temperatures, strafing from his own airplanes, and even a brutal 250-mile death march. But he survived it all, and now 60 years later, he's captured those experiences in a book called Missing Dog Tags. This Clovis veteran will turn 84 tomorrow on Veterans Day, but you'll hear his story today on Hometown Heroes. That's 1 o'clock on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our Hometown Heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Tomorrow is Veterans Day. I think you know that by now. It's also the birthday of the gentleman we're going to speak with today. And don't forget to make it to downtown Fresno if you're in the area for the Veterans Day Parade tomorrow morning. There's also a great event in Clovis from 3 to 5 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building, where they'll be showing some video histories of veterans throughout eras. Those histories have been produced by students here in the Valley for the last 10 years through the Center for Multicultural Cooperation, and that's a great event if you can get out there at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building from 3 to 5 tomorrow. Our guest today is not a veteran of World War II. So often, just about every week, we talk to World War II veterans, but today we're going to focus on what's been called the Forgotten War. It's a war that's impossible to forget. For Kenneth Eaton, who joins us today, he'll turn 84 tomorrow, but there were many nights during the Korean War where he didn't know if he'd see his next birthday. I want to start you out even earlier than that. You know, with every World War II veteran, I ask about Pearl Harbor Day, and you were alive for that. In fact, your older brother was a paratrooper in World War II. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Is that day still pretty crystal clear in your memory?
Yeah, it is. I lived in a little town called Carlsbad at that time, and I can remember my mother and father saying that the war has been declared, the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. And then within a couple of days, airplanes start, I never seen so many airplanes fly over the coast. I lived right on the coast. They were heading out to sea or heading to Hawaii to help out with what was going on there. Yes, I do remember it very vividly.
And you were just 13 years old at the time, but I understand you actually made some noise about wanting to sign up within not too long of that time.
Yes, that's very true. I wanted to join the, like my older brother did, he went into the paratroopers and was trained to jump.
And you would end up in the Army not too long after World War II. In fact, I guess, just about 3 years after the war was over, you were in the Army and headed to the Pacific yourself.
Yes, I joined 2 weeks before I turned 18. I joined, and I lived in Sanger then, and came to Fresno and enlisted. And they promised me, my dad was running a ranch there, a peach ranch. He needed myself and one of my brothers to work on a ranch and didn't want me to go into service and wouldn't sign for me at 17. So when I was becoming 18 years old, I joined, and they promised me they'd put me on a train and get me to San Francisco that very day.
And so that was only about a year after World War II had ended. Why were you so determined to get into the service? Why was that so important to you?
My older brother had came home and explained a lot to me about it. And I'm an American, and I wanted to do what all young Americans wanted to do in that era, is join and defend our freedom.
Little did you know what you'd be in for, huh?
Absolutely. I never dreamed that there would be another war right after the Second World War, so soon. My being in Japan when the war in Korea started got me over there. It started on June 15th, 1950, and I was there August 8th, shortly after it started.
And you would be there for a long time. And we're going to try to fit in as much of Mr. Eaton's story as we can in this hour. But there's a lot more that I know we won't be able to cover. And if you want to read all about it, you can read his new book, Missing Dog Tags. You can find that at Barnes & Noble on Amazon.com. I'll put those links up on our website also at KMJNow.com. It's a book that I've got to warn you is pretty intense. And there will be some situations that you won't see coming that will pull at your heartstrings, that'll turn your stomach a little bit. And it's authentic. There's some language in there, too, that might take you aback at times, but it's true to the experience that Mr. Eaton had back there in Korea. And if there's anything that you want to touch on from the time that you got to Korea until you were captured, feel free to do so. If not, maybe we can start with that incident where you first became a prisoner of the enemy forces.
Well, my outfit had been... We had completely defeated the North Koreans, and I'd been all the way up to the Yalu River, or within about 50 miles of that, when the Chinese attacked, and we fought a defensive thing for several weeks till we got back to... I was south of the 30th parallel when the Chinese set a line there and continued to attack us. My platoon had been assigned to Rock Division, which was, regiment, which was fighting some Chinese cavalry in a valley called Hongsong, about 3 miles north of this village. My platoon of tanks was there to give them the available 90 millimeter guns to try to hold the Chinese when we were overrun by the Chinese. And after 3 days, and I was captured on the February 11th. After my tank was, we'd been hit with a 3.5 bazooka, and it came inside the tank and blew up and killed three of the people within the tank, the driver and I. Well, the loader actually got out and died later, you know. Got out of the tank and concealed ourselves the best we could until the Chinese finally came, overran us there, and took us prisoner.
Well, and in reading your account of that incident in your book, Missing Dog Tags, the guy who was driving the tank was hit. You had to take over driving the tank. And then I vividly remember the way you described it there, because it got my attention. You basically said your head exploded. And I can't imagine what that feels like. Give us a sense of what that moment felt like for you. You're driving the tank, trying to find the road, trying to get in the right place while gunfire and artillery is going everywhere. And what happens?
Well, when you're a lot of automatic fire, the Chinese had this particular pass blocked where we couldn't get through without fighting our way through. The first tank had gone through. We had four tanks and radioed back. We were going to make individual runs at it, try to knock out their resistance so that we could get K Company. And we had over 500 American soldiers in this valley at the time trying to get out of this pass. First tank got through and radioed back and said, well, you can make it. It's all right. So the platoon leader and officer in charge of our platoon in the fourth tank said, okay, told the second tank, and we heard all the gunfire about a mile down the end of the valley, and he didn't radio back. So then the platoon leader, the lieutenant, told my tank commander for us to go, and we made a run for it, and that's when we got hit with a 3.5 bazooka and slid in behind the second tank, knocked out, and we blocked the pass entirely, two tanks. The lieutenant came in his tank about 15 or 20 minutes later, and I attempted to board his tank to get out of where I was at. I was lying behind a small slope. My tank commander had been there with me. I don't know where he went. I met him later on the death march. But I attempted to jump on the tank and was unable to do so while the lieutenant was getting... He'd got off of his tank and was pulling the dead and wounded out of the way so his driver wouldn't run over them as he came around on the sheltered side of my tank and the second tank to get his tank out of there. Well, he made it, but I never got on that tank.
No, you didn't, and you're left there to fend for yourself, not knowing what the rest of that day or any of those days would hold. And I'm curious, what had to be going through your mind in that moment? Because here you are, all of what, 21 years old, and you're out here in a war zone. You've just been knocked out of your tank. There's dead people all around you. How do you avoid just panicking in a situation like that?
Americans and human nature, I believe, is I've discussed this with a friend of mine just recently, and he asked me almost this same question. I think that my mind, as I recall, and that I do recall, is you're trying to figure out that your mind is racing, and you're trying to figure out the best way, or if you can, get out of the situation you're in. And I don't think that under that situation, a soldier really has time to think about fear. You're trying to get out of where you're at and move on.
And move on you did. And man, I'm really blown away by your story after having read it. 32 months in captivity, the torture, the freezing cold, the strafing from your own planes that you'd have to endure, and you even mentioned a death march. But before you were actually taken prisoner, you had an idea, I think probably in your head, of what it might be like. You had heard stories, right, of how the Chinese and North Koreans had been treating their prisoners?
Well, I'd been on armored patrol, I think, 3 or 4 times prior to this. And each time we'd go on armored patrol, there'd be 4 tanks and a couple of flak wagons and with quad 40s and quad 50s. And we'd be well protected by our take care of ourselves. And we'd come into villages where the North Koreans, we'd run the North Koreans out, or the infantry had ran them out. And we'd come up on maybe 10, 15 American soldiers with their hands wired behind them, and they'd been shot in the face on the ditches on each side of the dirt road. Or we'd find them within the village where they'd slaughtered, the North Koreans had slaughtered they call them political prisoners. Anyone that wasn't with them was against them, and they'd kill them. Men, women, children, it made no difference. Yes, I was aware of what the possibility was when I got captured.
Well, and really, it seems to me that just the idea of being captured was tantamount to death, that there was no reason to believe you could survive being a prisoner at their hands.
No, there wasn't, because of the knowledge I had and the experience I had prior to being captured. And so when I was first captured, I suspected that I probably would be shot within the hour. And the men around me immediately would. When we were left in a circle with guards around us in a stand of trees, we discussed that very lightly. Well, it looks like we're going to get what we've seen the other guys get. But as it turned out, the Chinese at that point in time had released some soldiers on the line a couple months before, or maybe a month before. And so they kept encouraging us to not feel that way, because they had a lenient policy now, and they were going to try to indoctrinate us. That was about communism, and their interpreters constantly talked to us when they had the time to explain this to us, where little by little we started to relax, well, some, until the death march started a couple of days later, and weeks later the death toll started from starvation and are wounded.
And you don't call it a death march for no reason. That very name implies what it was all about and what happened to many of the people on that march. And obviously when you started out, you had no idea how long they're going to march you or how far they're going to take you. You mentioned starvation. When did you get something to eat? And give us a sense of the things that began to appear to you as food that probably was never something you would imagine ingesting before.
Well, the very night of February the 11th, because of the continued activity of South Koreans trying to fight their way back in this valley, those of us that were captured from my platoon of tanks and some of the K Company infantry, they moved us about 300 yards off to the side up a small ravine, and there was an old building up there, and sometime during the night, they brought some South Korean soldiers in too, and there was maybe 60 of us at this time, and they brought out a tub of millet or sorghum cane seed. It's chicken feed boiled in water. down to a mush almost. Their guards set it down amongst us and told us to eat. Well, we learned that the word savala means eat, but we didn't know what that meant then. And the South Koreans just start sticking their hands in it and eating it, and like it was the best thing they'd ever eaten. So I never tried it, but another American soldier walked over and said, hey, maybe we should try this out. These must be good, the way these guys are eating it. So he put his hand in and took a handful out and put it in his mouth and spit it out and said, my God, I can't eat that. And, of course, when he spit it out, a Chinese guard kicked him about 4 feet.
And at that time, you weren't ready to try any of that. But I'm sure over time, the more desperate things got, the more willing you were to eat things. By the end of this march, not to gross anyone out who's listening, but you were eating, by the end of your captivity anyway, you were eating kernels of corn that had actually been pulled from ox droppings?
Yes, well, dried. They use a lot of their, they're not as mechanized, the Chinese nor the North Koreans, although they did have Russian trucks, all their supplies, but they also use oxen pulling carts with either ammo or mortar shells or their food on it. And of course, they're fed at the various villages where they lay over from coming down from China or the northern part of Korea, and they're fed corn with millet and chopped up sorghum cane. When the first man we seen pick up a paddy when we was crossing a road where oxen had been going, and they're breaking it up, and you're looking up and you see someone putting something in his mouth, the curiosity works on you till you find out what it is. And it was undigested corn, kernels of corn, where they'd been fed field corn, and it passed through them whole. And any time a dried paddy could be found, if we were on a road, someone picked it up. You were very lucky if you found one.
And I think that gives you a sense at home at how desperate things were for Mr. Eaton and his fellow prisoners during the Korean War. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll get into some of his escape attempts. Eventually, we'll get to the day he was liberated. But boy, did he endure some serious stuff between the time he was captured and his liberation 32 months later. He's written about it in the book Missing Dog Tags. You can pick that up at Amazon.com. You can read more about it on our website at KMJNow.com. And we'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes next on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Lux we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
Oh. on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Veterans Day weekend. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and this show hopefully brings you a little taste of Veterans Day all year long, reminding you the price that's been paid for the freedom that we enjoy every day. And our guest today also celebrates his 84th birthday tomorrow on Veterans Day. Ken Eaton is the author of Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. We're going to talk more about it. And I thought I would read you the dedication of this book. I'm really struck by the first page of the book and the last page. On the last page, you see a picture of Ken and his wife, Diane, when they were married. And it mentions their 4 children, 10 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren, 25 people who would have never been born had he not survived 32 months as a prisoner of war during the Korean War. The front page has this dedication. It says, "This book is dedicated to those 8,126 men who were missing in action or prisoners of war and have not yet been recovered, according to Department of Defense statistics, and also to my dear mother, whose faith in God and his ability to bring me home safely never wavered. God was faithful to bring him home. Those other men never did get to come home." And I imagine there were countless times where you thought you were going to be one of those guys who never came home. We talked about you being captured. You escaped 3 times only to be captured again. Never once were you actually executed. How many times did you think that's what was going to happen to you?
Well, each time I escaped, that would be the inevitable. They would execute you for that. Generally, the guard that followed, if he was the one that we called Geronimo, he had a round face and very heavily pockmarked, and him and 3 or 4 followed the main group always behind to just catch those who was trying to escape or became too sick to continue. He took care of the wounded in that way. He'd shoot them. And that went on time and time again. In my presence, I seen that happen to other GIs who escaped and was caught, and they'd shoot them. I can only say that God and my luck and my ability to speak a little bit of the Japanese language to talk to these people saved me from being executed each time I escaped, because the threat was always there. In fact, is the second time I escaped, I dug my own grave. Well, partially dug it until I got to talk in Japanese to these 2 North Korean soldiers, impress them with the possibility. I think they thought I was a downed pilot, and when they had recaptured me, and it would be a feather in their hat to turn me over to their superiors, perhaps, and that stopped them from shooting me and making me finish burying and digging my own grave.
But that whole time, you're digging that grave. You're dealing with this emotion, this fear that this is it. I can't imagine what that must feel like to be digging your own grave and knowing that pretty soon, in just a few moments, you're going to be in there. Did you feel any sense of encouragement, comfort from somewhere that, you know, gave you that little inkling of hope that maybe this wasn't going to be it for you?
How your mind really works under circumstances like that, it's human nature for one to try to find a way out. You're thinking as fast as you can, analyzing every direction you look and every person around you, trying to figure out how you're going to get out of the problem you're in. And for fear to interfere with that, you're a loser. And it just didn't seem to happen to me. I don't think it happens to anyone under those circumstances. Actually, they're trying to find a way out of what's happening.
And your book doesn't pull any punches that I know of. There's some intense detail in there. There are things that I think really for most of us are unimaginable, but you bring it to life. And I don't know how much you want to get into that in this interview, but I want to give you the opportunity to give our listeners a real sense of what you endured with the knowledge that you weren't the only one that endured this. And I know that's one of the reasons you wrote this book. And I say it's a new book, Missing Dog Tags, because it's been published this year, but you wrote it within 5 or 6 years of coming home from your days as a prisoner of war. So it's a new book and an old book at the same time for you. Give us a sense, if you can, wherever you're willing to go, with the worst that your captors did to you. I remember one narrative in there about you waking up and there are your captors standing over you, urinating on your face. I mean, that's just a taste of some of the things. What was the worst for you, the hardest for you to endure?
Well, I think the hardest for me to endure was the actual death march. I was with something in excess of 700 soldiers, and that was all Americans. Well, some mixed UN, but very little mixed UN, and no South Koreans. And the starvation would take such a toll on us that there were so many young fellas. I was 20, and there was many 17-year-olds. Everybody had matted beards full of lice, and you couldn't tell how old anyone was. But on talking to them, you'd find out that they were kids. And the fact that the starvation to start after a couple of months took such heavy toll, we would have guys who would get down to where they wouldn't even eat a little bit that they were given. And we called it the big eye, that we'd be sitting in a room on these layovers in these villages, and one would get the big eye, and generally that person would be dead by the following morning. When we'd wake up, he'd just be sitting up against the wall or wherever he was at, and we would know the night before that we're going to lose him. And you couldn't, if you gave him a steak, he would need it then. He'd fight you for bothering him. That was maybe ranks close to anything that maybe happened to me, is to be in that situation time and time again, staying in these villages over during the day when my friends and these young fellows would die that away from starvation.
And there's one point in the book where you talk about how many days you had been in captivity, and you talk about seeing someone die at least once a day, people that you either knew or were around, and you witnessed that. And you talk about the death march. Put in perspective for our listeners how long this death march lasted, how much ground you covered, and the conditions you had to deal with, because it wasn't just starvation that threatened to end your life.
Well, I was captured 15 miles south of the 30th parallel, and I don't know the exact mileage, but some of the officers thought we were going to walk 500 miles to get to the Yalu River. I since have been told that we walked between 250 and 300 miles on a starvation diet, which was, the walking was killing us, because of they only fed us if they found any kind of grain in these villages where the North Korean people had left because of fear of the North Korean soldiers. And if there's anything left there to be fed, that's what we ate. And if there was nothing there, we didn't eat. And some days we'd go 2 or 3 days without a single meal. And then they'd find a village larger with where they could feed us 2 meals a day for 2 or 3 days till they had to move out again. And then it was just up and down. One day you get a meal, the next day you'd get two, the next day 2 or 3 days you might not get any. And that's what took the largest toll on us. But in answer to your question, it's back to the death march and the starvation and our own airplanes. We were strafed many times by our own airplanes. They would be en route back to their base, still have ammo in their planes, and they would dive down on the villages to see if it was a Russian truck or any North Korean soldiers or Chinese there, and they'd strafe a few houses, and if anybody ran out, then they would maybe rocket and bomb and strafe a lot more if there's 3 or 4 planes. But the Chinese impressed us with the fact that if you come out of the house, when we get strafed, our guards will shoot you, because they're dug in all around the buildings until they move us out in the evenings. And so you had to stay inside, and our own planes would kill us that way, and they didn't know it.
You know. So you guys are inside these houses, shoulder to shoulder, on the floor, up against the walls, everywhere, knowing that somebody's going to die, and praying that the bullets, the shrapnel, whatever, isn't going to hit you. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's a fair assessment of what would take place. You just wouldn't know. A couple of times, I would try to we would find leaf tobacco when they move us into these villages. Sometimes if the place had a manger where they had, if several of them owned an ox in there that work the fields or pull the carts. Well, they would grow leaf tobacco or buy it from another village, perhaps, and be dried in bundles out in the manger hanging up. And we'd find that and take tear paper off the walls and make, if we didn't have any propaganda paper, to roll and make a cigarette to smoke. And at those times, one time I moved to the outside edge of a building because we were being strafed, and a queen, one of the drivers of my second tank, who got knocked out first, was still alive. And he had told me earlier that he had found some tobacco a couple of days earlier, had some in his pocket, and I just had to have a smoke. I was so nervous about what was going on. And that only one time a plane had come down, but it was P-51s, propel craft, and they come straight down. They don't strafe like a jet. And they just scream bloody murder, and it's that alone will just almost kill you, the fear of what's going to happen when he gets closer to that village and starts pulling a trigger and firing those 50s and 30 caliber machine guns off his wings and the nose of his plane in the building. But at this particular time, they killed about 15 guys and wounded about 30, and they're in about 35 or 40 houses. The Chinese moved us out when that wing of planes left, knowing they would send someone back because someone had been outside and attracted them. And when we came back off the side of the hill later on that afternoon, when the planes finally didn't come anymore, there was about 15 or maybe 16 bodies thrown in a ravine right next to the building. They were just throwing them in like they were stacking cordwood.
And this became your daily experience, something that you were just faced with day in, day out. So there was the starvation. There was the exhaustion of marching, eventually 250 miles. There was the friendly fire from American aircraft dive bombing and strafing you on a daily basis. And then there was the weather. I mean, people in World War II talk about the Battle of the Bulge and how brutal that winter was. You guys were dealing with conditions just as bad, if not worse, 40, 50 below zero?
Yes, 40, 50. Even the winter of 50 and the 51 up until the end of February or maybe even the middle of March, that far north got 60 below. Many guys died with gangrene from having frozen feet because they couldn't dry their feet or didn't have more socks to change like we'd had on the front lines, or had forced to wade through water, and then their feet would freeze, or they'd give us one break a night, but the break would last anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, and we'd just freeze when we should have been up walking. Instead of having a break that long and around midnight at night, and the guys would get feet would be black, gangrene would set in above the feet that had been frozen, and with no doctors to take care of us, ultimately a lot of those guys died. A lot of guys lost their feet, lost their toes, even some guys lost their hands because they didn't keep their hands warm from the sub-zero weather.
And the more I hear about that, the more I read in your book, the more I'm amazed that you survived and you're in the kind of shape you're in today, turning 84 tomorrow. Ken Eaton is our guest today. His book, Missing Dog Tags, describes many of the things we've talked about in captivating detail, and some of the stuff he just mentioned with the frozen feet, the frozen extremities, some of the more stomach-turning moments of that book. But it hits home for you. The price that has been paid for our freedom, what lengths some people have gone and some people have endured to make sure that we are a free country and that we promote that freedom around the world. When we come back, we'll get more of Mr. Eaton's story, tell you more about how you can get the book, Missing Dog Tags. It's a Korean War edition of Hometown Heroes today on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Tomorrow is Veterans Day, also the birthday of our guest today, Ken Eaton. He'll be 84, but back during the Korean War, he didn't think he'd live to see 22 or 23 or 24. Didn't think he'd meet a wife someday. Have 4 kids, 10 grandkids, 11 great-grandkids. But that was God's plan for him, and he can look back and see a lot of close calls, many more than most of us can count on our hands. We're going to talk about some more of those and talk more about his book, Missing Dog Tags. If you want to get it, you can go to Barnes & Noble online or go to Amazon.com. We've got a link up at our website, kmjnow.com. He lives in Clovis, California, and he'd be happy to talk to you about his story sometime, I'm sure. One of the ex-prisoners of war from the Korean War, a war that's been called the Forgotten War. Certainly not something he can forget. And let's get back to his story now. You talked about the horrors of that 250-mile death march, the starvation, the freezing cold, the strafing by American planes. We've also talked about the mistreatment that you received from your captors. They also wanted to indoctrinate you and convince you that communism was the best way. How did you take to that, this attempted indoctrination? They had you watch films, read books, listen to lectures. Did you kind of just shrug it off? How did you deal with that?
The lectures were at least twice a week in the camp I was in. When I finally got on the Yalu River, they had a real large building made with an auditorium with a deck on it, a stage in the far end of it. And you could probably get 300 or more of us in there, and they would rotate. They had us in this camp, had us segregated by race, by rank, and country for indoctrination. They didn't want the officers with enlisted men. They didn't want the higher rank sergeants with corporals and privates. And they segregated the black from the white, and the Spanish and Latin American people from everyone else. They even mixed them with Hawaiian, as I recall. And they would indoctrinate us in this couple of times a week if they could rotate the camp through this building that fast. At that time, there was about 1,500 in the camp I was in. There had originally been about 5,000, and the death rate on my death march that I endured, well, the same thing was happening in this camp. There had been about 5,000 there, and half the camp had died off at the rate of 30 or 40 a day in the winter of 50 into 51. When I was on the death march. Anyway, the indoctrination, you had to set up. You better pay attention. They did give tests. They weren't extensive, but you had to pay attention. They would read things about and explain about Marxism and Engels and Stalinism and Mao Zedong. Seemed like everybody had written something about communism, and they wanted us all to have an understanding of that and how great it was for China and how great it had been for the Russians. And if you didn't answer some of the questions properly when they had a test a day or two later, you didn't eat for a day or two or three, or you may be thrown in a vegetable hole up by the kitchen with a bucket of water dumped over you for two or three days. And some guys didn't survive that in those, even that time of the year, because of freezing at night. Or they'd make you stand outside and dump water on you until you decided you wanted to pay attention and pass their test and pretend like you were believing some of the things they tried to teach you about communism.
And I don't want to stray too far from your individual experience, but when you step back and you look at the big picture, with that in mind, everything you just described about the way they tried to indoctrinate you, the way they wanted things to be, the way that you were treated, keeping in mind that the Korean War still technically isn't over. There's still the demilitarized zone there on the 38th parallel. Do you ever step back and say, you know, it was really important what Americans did there, because had we let them have their way, that our world would look a whole lot different tonight? Did that give you a glimpse of the world they wanted to come about?
Yes. The spread of communism, if they could have taken over South Korea, then their next step would have been Japan. And with the Chinese, the many millions, they have more there than the rest of the Asian nations around them there. They perhaps would have been able to do that. And we might have been fighting a different kind of war today, the spread of communism. But our defense of freedom with the Russians and with the Chinese and with the North Koreans, it's stalemated. We haven't gone anywhere beyond that, but we've stopped them also.
And one of the best illustrations I've had shared with me over the years, if people don't get that and don't see the importance of the Korean War, is that nighttime satellite photo of the Korean Peninsula. Have you seen that, with South Korea all lit up and North Korea completely pitch black?
South Korea looks like San Diego, and it's wonderful to know that.
And it wouldn't look like that without the sacrifices that you and so many other veterans of that era made. Ken Eaton is our guest. He was a prisoner of war for 2.5 years in Korea during the 1950s. He's written about it in his book, Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. You can find that online. Go to our website, kmjnow.com, for more details about that. As time goes on, I imagine there's part of you that becomes more hopeful and another part of you that becomes less hopeful, that if you've been in captivity all this time, the chances of you eventually succumbing the way so many around you have are increasing. But you had some hope. I know this because several times along the way, you took out a little spiral notebook and scribbled some notes in English, hoping that some of the civilians in the area would get those notes out and that they'd find their way back home. Did any of those notes make it home? Were your parents, was your family able to find out that you were indeed alive and not dead over there?
Yes, I had a little blue spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen my mother had included in a belated Christmas present that came to me while I was over there. And I started writing notes, giving my name, rank, serial number, my company, 2nd Division, 9th Tank. Please notify my company commander and the Air Force to stop bombing the villages. They're killing us. And please notify my mother and father. And 7 or 8 of those, when I come home, they'd gone through the War Department, and my mother and father had them in the scrapbook to show me.
And I don't want to gloss over anything, so if there's something you think is important to mention before we get to that moment, feel free. But I don't want to miss out on what that felt like to you to finally be a free man again, because here you've been beaten, you've been tortured, you've starved, you've frozen, you've been shot at by your own airplanes, and yet it's still possible for you to survive all this and to be a free man again. How did that come about, and what did that feel like?
Well, it was the most wonderful thing that that you could ever experience for a person like me and those with me. When we were hauled, taken from the camp on a train, and then unloaded and hauled by trucks to a village nearby Panmunjom, where we were to be traded, one American soldier for maybe 2,000 Chinese or Koreans, because we had that, our army had captured that many more of them than the Chinese had left of us. Anyway, when the truck I was in was backed into Pamajon and I was unloaded from the back of the truck, all I could see was 10 Marines in starched uniforms standing in a row. And God, we just couldn't wait to get out and touch one of them with our hands to prove to ourselves that we were free. We were free at last, and it wasn't going to be another trick.
Because you had seen plenty of those along the way. And to get back to the States, you dedicate this book to your mother and her prayers to see her again. What was that moment like?
Well, that was wonderful. My mother and my father, they met me at San Francisco when we come in a ship, and we spent some wonderful days just being together, and my brothers and sister and my sister-in-laws, and it was just wonderful. It was still hard to believe that I really was back in America on American soil. It took me weeks to trying things out and smelling things and looking at things and to believe that I really was back in America.
I can't imagine going through what you went through, and your book spells it out, like I said, in vivid detail, all the things that you endured. I can't imagine having that experience and that experience not changing your perspective a little bit. Did you find yourself back in the States trying to find some idea of a normal life again, taking less for granted or having a little different outlook on things because of what you'd been through?
Yes, I did. I had a terrible outlook on life at first, thinking every day, like I did when I was a prisoner of war, that tomorrow may not come, may never come. But little by little, I melted back into daily life. It took some months, but I melted back into daily life and learned to pick up where I had left off or been with my family prior to my going in the service. And it took several years, I'm sure, that before I was 100%, but I am there now. Thank God.
Amen. And a couple other things I want to talk to you about before we close out the program. You have medals displayed here in your home in Clovis, and one medal is missing that I think anybody who reads your book and sees what you went through, how you were wounded when your tank was blown up and also beaten and hurt badly in captivity, there's no Purple Heart up there. And it's not because you don't deserve it. You decided that you couldn't handle having it because of what else you saw? Explain to me that reasoning, why you didn't feel worthy of the Purple Heart.
Well, I from the time capture and the death march and all the wounded and the ones who died from their wounds and the ones we tried to help along the trail at night to carry them until finally they succumbed to their wounds. And the things I seen and lived with in the main camp when I finally got there almost a year later, the different 17-year-olds and 35-year-olds with missing legs and shot in the face and arms missing and almost anything you can imagine, I couldn't accept a Purple Heart after being with those kind of people.
Well, I think everybody hears you loud and clear. And finally, we have this book today, but I mentioned you wrote this book more than 50 years ago, and there were times where you thought about having it published before. It didn't work out for whatever reason, but you'd had it buried among things here and hadn't thought of it for quite some time, I understand. And it's your family that convinced you to pick it back up again, and that's why we have this book today. Tell me how that came about, and I guess what emotion that leaves you with now.
Well, I after two attempts to get it published in the early years, it was considered to be too harsh of an experience for publishing companies, and so I just gave up on it. But my family continued, especially my wife and my children. They wanted the book published, not only for people to find out what happened in Korea, but for my children too, for them to have information about what their father had gone through. It's been a relief to have this happen, to have the book published.
Well, And your family won't be the only people who benefit from reading this story and understanding what can happen in a time of war and what things, what experiences, what horrific atrocities some Americans have gone through for the sake of freedom. It gives us a lot less to take for granted, and hopefully it gives us a lot of respect and admiration for those who put their lives on the line for us every day. Veterans Day, when it rolls around every year, I know it's your birthday, but in the bigger picture, what does Veterans Day mean to you?
Well, it's my birthday. It's my birthday, but I do celebrate Veterans Day for all of those great guys who was in the Second World War that did so much for our country and previous wars and the wars that's going on today, the young fellows that's out there that's sacrificing their life and coming home wounded, missing limbs. Veterans Day is a great day, and we should all hold those fellows up high.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for everything that you went through and for having the courage to go back there emotionally and share that story with us so we can understand. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know?
No, I think if I would appreciate it so that my experience is told around the country. If you have a friend, tell them about the book. I think especially if they're a veteran, and those who aren't veterans will appreciate it, what I've tried to tell you about it, about what happened in Korea.
Absolutely. And again, that book is Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. Kenneth Eaton is the author. And if you want to see what that book looks like, go to our website at kmjnow.com. We'll have the link right there for you to get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Hope you take time tomorrow to honor all the veterans in your life and join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.